You are listening to KDRT LP 95.7 here in Davis, California. My name is Lois Richter. The program is called That's Life. And today I have a guest who has consented to be interviewed. His name is David Peskin, or Rabbi David, or...
Consented? That sounds threatening. I don't know, Lois.
Well, will you agree? Will that be better?
More than agree. It's an honor.
Hello, David. Tell us who you are, where you are, and how you know me.
I am David Peskin. I'm a rabbi living in sunny South Florida, Miami, Florida. I spent most of my adult career up in Massachusetts. I spent 25 years up there as a congregational rabbi, serving in a community in Canton, Massachusetts, and then moved down here to Florida. And now I've transitioned out of the pulpit life, and now I do educational work. So I basically play with kids all day, and it's the best job in the entire world. I'm also the the rock and roll rabbi. I've got 7 albums out of contemporary Jewish music, and I'm the Torah tech guy trying to help Jewish communities up their game and do better engagement and creative thinking and creative planning and programming using digital tools. And we know each other through, boy, a couple different places, from office hours, from the Zoom test kitchen, from I'm a fan of Birding with Lois, and probably a few other places that I can't even remember.
That's why I wanted to have you on the show, is to talk about 3 different things. One is your life history, how it worked, and you know, your enthusiasms. One is, I figure since I got a rabbi on the show, I can ask some questions about Jewish.
Bring it on. I'm here for you.
And then if we get to it, maybe some tech talk. But
you got it.
Let's start with the broad picture. You are a rabbi.
Yes.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? So the word rabbi means teacher. And fundamentally, at its best, a rabbi is someone who tries to share the wisdom of the Torah, which is the Hebrew Bible, share the wisdom of the rabbinical interpretations over thousands of years of those books, of the biblical books, and tries to teach people how to live a life of gratitude, a life of awe, a life of joy. So fundamentally, it's I'm a teacher. And I also get to, as a part of my job, I get to participate with people in life cycle events. As morbid as it sounds, the one of the greatest honors is when a family invites you to be a part of the journey of a loved one whose life is coming to an end. Mm-hmm. What a deep and profound honor it is to be invited in a moment like that. And I've had the honor of doing that more than a few times. And of course, the joyful ones also, births and bar mitzvahs and all that other good stuff. But I'm really a cheerleader for God.
Oh, I like that one, a cheerleader.
Yeah.
That's cool. So a rabbi would be part of a group of people, a congregation, is it called? Or do you have a different word for that?
So, you know, it's interesting, Lois, because there's actually a bit of a transformation or a transition happening in, I would say, the religious world in general, but I only can speak for the Jewish world. So the answer to your question is yes. Generally speaking, a rabbi in modern times was connected to a synagogue or a temple, a congregation. And so, you know, each congregation would have a rabbi. They may have a cantor also, who is the kind of the musical component of the clergy team. In my career, I was what they call a kolbo. Kolbo means everything's in it, because I did the music, I did the rabbi, I did all that other stuff. I was the janitor. And you'll have a number of smaller congregations that will have one person who kind of is the sole clergy person. But what's interesting, the shift that we're seeing is fewer and fewer rabbis wanting to work in traditional pulpit congregational roles. And I think that's in part because there's a shift, a demographic shift and a communal shift away from organized religion. I think we're seeing this across the United States that many, many people identify as spiritual or even religious, but don't feel the need to belong, as it were, or to affiliate with a specific congregation. And so a number of congregations are merging or they're shrinking or what have you. And rabbis are, I think, the ones who are really being thoughtful and having foresight are thinking outside the box about what does it mean to be that teacher, that cheerleader for God, when it doesn't happen necessarily in a congregational setting.
So let me split my questions here. First, talk about the congregational setting and then about the more modern setting. In a congregational setting, now, the congregation's the people and the synagogue is the building. Is that right? Or is the synagogue the people too?
It's a good question.
Or is the word have multiple meanings?
So the Hebrew word is Beit Knesset. Beit means a house of, Knesset means gathering. There are actually three words for what a synagogue is. It's a Beit Knesset, a house of gathering, a Beit Tfilah, a house of prayer, and a Beit Limud, and a house of learning. So a synagogue is supposed to be all three of those. I think you're right that the word congregation probably refers more to the people that make up or that are members of the synagogue. You could certainly have congregations without a physical building. Mm-hmm. There are many, actually. I'm not sure if you could have a synagogue without a physical building. It's interesting. And then in the Reform community, which is the more liberal wing of Judaism, they tend to call it a temple as opposed to a synagogue. But it's, for all intents and purposes, it's the three words are synonymous.
Okay. So when the people in the synagogue get together for worship, that's the proper term, is worship, or is there a different term?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Is there a specific order of service? Well, that's what I heard it called. Is there specific thing that says, and this will happen, and this will happen, and this will happen, and this will happen? Is it structured?
It is very structured. We are OCD. We are, yes. In fact, so much so that the book that we use is called a Siddur. And the word Siddur means order. So if you open up any Jewish Siddur, any Jewish prayer book, you will see, depending on what service you're looking at, because there's an evening service, a morning service, an afternoon service, you'll see a very specific order for what prayers you should say in what order. Now, you know, does every synagogue do every prayer in the same order? No, we have a little wiggle room. We're not, I don't know what the English word is, but we're not so rigid. We're a little rigid, but we're not so rigid. But yes, there is absolutely a structure. And the way that I've often thought of it is like a spiritual workout.
First you warm up, then you do your strength exercise, then you get some stretching.
Exactly. So you start by stretching out your muscles so you don't pull anything. Then you warm up, and then you really start to push that your heart muscle, right? Eventually you hit your target heart rate, and then you cool down. We have the same exact structure in Jewish prayer services. The very first piece is called Birchot HaShachar. It's the morning blessings, and that's the stretching. Then we've got Pesukah DeZimra. That's the warm up. Then we've got Shacharit, and that's the real workout. Then you've got the Torah service. That's the target heart rate. And then you've got Musaf, which is the cool down. So it's very much structured.
Is that all in one session, or are those talking about five different sessions? No,
all in one session. So
all in one session.
That's all in one. Yeah, they're not. They don't have to be terribly long. And like I said before, there are three different, there's a morning service, afternoon, and evening service. I was just describing the morning service on a Saturday morning.
Okay. So if I were in one congregation and I went to another congregation, obviously since it's doing the same similar order, it should be really easy to do that. Yeah.
You'd think so, wouldn't you?
Well, if you've got the same book.
You don't have the same book.
Oh, you don't have the same book.
So there are lots of...
Every different congregation makes its own book?
No, not necessarily. But there are lots of different types of prayer books. Uh-huh. And again, they're all going to have, well, you know, because look, this one puts one out with this translation, and this one puts one out with this beautiful artwork, and this one puts one out with these readings, you know, so the structure is going to be the same. The overall structure will be the same. Mm-hmm. There may be, and there very, very well would be, I think, specifics that are different. And there are pieces that may sound familiar or feel familiar. There are other pieces that may not. One of the pieces that may get in the way of that familiarity is the tunes. There are lots and lots of different tunes to these prayers. We sing everything, us Jews. We don't say anything really. We kind of sing everything. And there are lots of different tunes. And, you know, if you go to one temple, they'll sing it one way. If you go to another temple, they'll sing it another way. And that's just preference. It's not, there's no kind of code of law about what tunes you're allowed to use for what prayers, although there are certainly traditions and customs. And so that's one way that it may feel very different from one synagogue to another.
Do the temples aggregate with each other into larger groups that are then fairly do the same things? In other words, would there be, you know, a group of 10 temples and they're all using the same book?
Yeah. So we have what's called movements in Judaism. And I imagine it's a little bit like Protestant, Catholic, Baptist, mm-hmm. in that there are, so for example, there's Orthodox Judaism, which tends to be quite more rigid than others, more traditional. And there isn't one prayer book that they share, but their prayer books will all look much more similar to one another than prayer books used by someone who is not in an Orthodox synagogue. Then you've got conservative, which is kind of in the middle. Then you've got reform, which is more on the liberal side. You've got reconstructionist. You've got humanistic. So there are lots of different ones. Mm-hmm. And we call those movements. And yes, the synagogues that affiliate with each of those movements do tend to look and feel more similar to one another than the ones that are not in them. I call myself an under-constructionist Jew.
Under-constructionist?
Because I am under-constructionist, because I'm always under construction. I'm always becoming, I'm always learning, and I am very much in process, and I always want to be.
And which movement are you part of?
I would put myself in the under-constructionist movement, which of course is not really a movement.
So you made your own movement.
I made my own, exactly. Right.
Okay.
So I've been in all of them. So I grew up in a typical conservative Jewish home. When I went to college and in high school and college, I became very Orthodox. At the end of college, I moved over to the Reform world. I started my rabbinical studies at the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. I then finished my rabbinical studies at a pluralistic school, so it brings from all of them. I then worked for 20 years in a conservative synagogue. I now work at a Reform synagogue. I've been all over the place. And that's because for me, there's real beauty in all of them. We spend so much time thinking about those things that differentiate us from one another and not appreciating how beautiful and precious those differences can be, and how valuable it is to honor those differences instead of being afraid of them or threatened by them. And so, I think back to when I was in the Orthodox world. If you're a Reform Jew, you really don't connect at all to Orthodox Judaism or the philosophies or the theologies of Orthodox Judaism. I find them quite beautiful. I think they're incredibly powerful. And I think we have a lot to learn from Orthodox Judaism, just as I think Orthodox Jews have a lot to learn from Reform Judaism. So I want to bring it all together.
You're a togetherist. So I'm a Quaker, and in the Quaker world, there are different branches or strands or whatever, but an individual joins a monthly meeting. In other words, I live in Davis, my meeting is Davis Monthly Meeting, but that's my affiliation. And I am not a member of Sacramento Monthly Meeting or Sacramento Friends Meeting, however you want to call them, even though they're only 20 miles away. And we're a from the bottom up kind of thing. So Sacramento meeting, Davis meeting, Berkeley meeting, whatever, we might get together in what's called a quarterly meeting so that our group of meetings will do some project that takes more than just one meeting to do. But that quarterly meeting is not an authority over us. It's just a joint working group, if you will. And then above quarterly meeting, there's yearly meeting. And so I, being a Quaker and a member of this meeting, I could go to any other Friends meeting in the world, but it wouldn't be my meeting. It's not like the Catholics, where there's the Pope who tells the bishops, who tells and you finally filter down to telling the people what to do. Doesn't work that way here. How does it work in Judaism?
So one of the unique aspects of Judaism is the story of Revelation. If you think about the Christian revelation, in Christian revelation, God spoke to or ordained or gave birth to, however you want to imagine it, Jesus, one person. And then he had disciples. In Islam, God, Allah, spoke to Muhammad, and then Muhammad had disciples. In Judaism, we don't have just one guy who heard or was revealed to by God. The story of revelation in Judaism is by design that God revealed God's self to everyone, all at the same time, in a way that they would be able to understand, appreciate, and receive. And it's not just the people who are alive then, it's the Torah, the Bible explicitly says it was everyone who's alive now, who's standing here at the mountain, everyone who was before a part of this Jewish community, and everyone who ever will be a part of this Jewish community. The meaning of that, the import of that communal revelation, is that there is no one person or one group of people who is in charge, who has more of a say than anyone else. And so by definition, Judaism is meant to be democratic. It's meant to that each person should have autonomy over their own beliefs, over their own actions. Having said that, we also have this image of if you imagine dropping a stone in water, the ripples closest to where you drop the stone are larger than the ones that extend out, and they get smaller and smaller and smaller as you go out. They never disappear, but they're small, infinitely smaller, 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 smaller. For us, Sinai was the moment that the stone fell into the water. And so the closer, for me, and I think you to a certain extent also, I always want the newest iPhone. I want the newest computer. I want the newest mic. I want the newest, 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 newest. For Jews, it's really the other way around. Because the closer you are to that dropping of the stone in the water, as it were, the closer you are to the source, the greater the ripple effect is on you. And so the farther we get away in time from Sinai, the perhaps more distant the revelation sounds. And so, yes, we are by design democratic, and if you ask a rabbi, who has more authority, me, David, or some great rabbi, Rambam from the 12th century, Rambam's going to have more authority, not only because he was smarter, not only because he knew more, but because he's closer to the source in time.
Let me delve into that a little bit. So Ramdan, is that the right way to pronounce it?
Rambam.
Rambam.
We have the coolest names.
Oh, yeah.
Help me, Rambam. Help me, Rambam.
Oh, that's right. You're the rock and roll rabbi. I got that now. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So when Rambam was alive, there were a lot fewer people in the world. And so that voice was a higher percentage of the Jews alive at that time.
Okay, wait. Oh my goodness. This is so beautiful, Lois.
What?
So yes, what you just said.
Yeah.
It was such great Torah. Here's what we do. Here's what I do. When someone shares a great little piece of Torah, great little teaching, you give them one of these. I don't know why, but you give them a psh. That was, so you're right. There were fewer people in the world. And so, yes, his voice, his teaching was perhaps a greater percentage. But I'll tell you what else there was. When there are fewer people, there's fewer noise
right.
and fewer distractions.
That's right.
And one of the beautiful pieces about again, about Jewish revelation, about the revelation of God to the Jewish people, is that it happened in the desert. Mm-hmm. And that, again, that's by design, right?
No distraction.
That's right. We are so, when people say, God never talks to me, I never see God, you know why?
Shut up and listen.
Exactly. We're on our phone all day long. We're on our computer all day, and I'm the worst at it. But there's beautiful, there's really sacred truth in what you just said, that Rambam both perhaps had more authority because of the number of people and the percentage or the value of his voice, but also because there was less noise. Mm-hmm.
That actually resounds quite a lot with me, being a Quaker of the unprogrammed meeting tradition. We gather together, and the first thing we do when we sit down together is we try and turn off the brain, turn off those thoughts, try stop. Don't think about the grocery list. You can do that later. Just try to settle. I call it centering. Other people call it settling into silence, whatever. And try to listen. And Quakers believe that God is talking to everybody, and you just have to shut up and listen.
Amen.
Some people are hear better than others. And so sometimes if you listen and you get a message, sometimes it solves a problem of your own. And that's wonderful. And you just go, oh, thank you. But sometimes you're going, I don't think this is for me. Maybe it's for somebody else. And so you figure out how to concisely say your ministry, and you stand up and you say it. And it's incredibly powerful when, after meeting is over, three people come up to you and said, that's what I needed to hear.
Yeah.
And it's like, God couldn't get through to them, but it got through to me. So I say it.
You have time for a story?
I do.
All right, ready? So this is a story of one of the greatest storytellers in all of Judaism. His name is the Baal Shem Tov, the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov lived, is it 15th, 16th? I could be wrong. It's probably 18th century. Forgive me, I should know that. 18th century, I think. And so there's the story that the Baal Shem Tov tells about a businessman who had to go on a trip. And in order to go on this trip, he needed to take his assistant. Now, his assistant had never been out of town. He had never been on a trip. There was no rhyme or reason why, you know, he should be able to do this. But the business person needed this assistant to come to carry his bags, to take notes, to do whatever. So they went on the trip. The business person went to the conference. The assistant did what he needed to do. Beautiful, done, wonderful. After this was all over, before they came back, the assistant had time to go out for a drink, went to a restaurant, went to a bar, whatever, met someone there, had an interaction, and then they all came home. Now, at first blush, we think we know why the business person and this assistant went on this trip. We think the business person and the assistant went on this trip because the business person had to attend to work and the assistant was there to help him. That's not why they went. They went because the assistant needed to interact with this person at the bar, and there was no way that he would get there on his own. So this idea that we can be instruments or the limbs of the divine, that we can not only bring God into our own lives, but bring God into other people's lives, and that we don't always know why things happen, is very beautiful. I imagine God. When I was growing up, Lois, we had one of those station wagons where the back seat was reversed, so you could sit and look out the back window. And I used to love sitting back there, and I would count the trees as they sped by, and I would try and get the trucks to honk their horns by moving my arm up and down. I always knew where we were going. But I had no idea how we were going to get there. I didn't know if we'd have to take a right or a left, or if my father would have to stop and get gas, or if there'd be a pothole. And frankly, I didn't care. I was much too busy counting the trees and trying to get the trucks to honk their horns. And that's how I imagine my life with God. I'm in the backseat of God's car. God's driving. I know where we're going. You know, I know the destination. But I don't know how I'm going to get there. I don't know if there will be rough patches or smooth patches, or if I'll have to stop for gas or any of that. And honestly, I don't really care. I just want to count the trees along the way.
But you're looking backwards. And so you're seeing where you've been. You're seeing the moment now and everything that's gone before, and you do not have a clue what's coming up ahead.
That's right.
That's a perfect description of life, isn't it?
And yeah, and you know, and I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
Whether or not you're okay with that, that's the way life is.
Fair enough, fair enough. But I'm okay letting God take the wheel, which doesn't absolve me from responsibility. Goodness, no. I mean, I work for social justice all the time, and you know, this isn't a throw up your hands because God will take care of it. It just means for those things that are unknown, for those things that are truly beyond my capacity to influence, in those moments, I turn to God. For everything else, it's on me and all the rest of us.
So I want to tell you a little bit about what I value about being a Quaker. Just like what we were talking about, I believe that I can listen. If I listen well, I might get a message from God. I might have some divine inspiration or whatever. But being a Quaker, when I get those things that I'm convinced is my instructions and what I'm supposed to do, I get to go and talk to other people in the meeting and get clear on whether or not I misplaced a comma and whether I'm supposed to turn right at the bridge or I'm supposed to turn right at the bridge. And you know, I had turn right at the bridge. I never made it to the meeting house. I got totally lost until I went back and someone reread that and said, "Oh, no, there's no comma in there. It should have been there." And we went back, ha, we got where we were going. So that whole being inspired individually, but being supported as a community. It sounds to me like that's the same that happens to your congregations.
That's so beautiful. That is so beautiful. And to a certain extent, yes, I wish it happened more like that. I think that you know, you were talking before about how democratic, or it was my language, but how democratic Judaism is. And in some ways, I think us rabbis have really sort of ruined Judaism for a lot of people. And because there came a time when 20, 30, 40, no, even more than that, I would say 50, 60 years ago, synagogues were the primary way of sort of identifying as a Jew. You belonged to a synagogue, and it was the social center of your life. And synagogues built themselves up based on membership. And so when families said, we're going to become members of the synagogue, what are you going to offer us? We said, well, we'll teach your children and we'll do your life cycle events and we'll, you know, and we'll celebrate the holidays and all of this other stuff. And unfortunately, what happened is families became so reliant on the synagogue to teach their children and to lead prayer and to celebrate the holidays, that in some ways we ripped that we ripped that away from families. You know, we stole away their own capacity to learn, to teach, to pray, to celebrate. And we said to them, oh, it all happens in the context of the synagogue. And so in some ways, I think that in a Jewish community, if somebody has, as you said, if, you know, if they hear something, if they feel something, if they need help interpreting something, more often than not, they'll go to the rabbi. And I wish it were not that. I wish it were more, we sit around a circle. We all have equal, we are an equal opportunity God listeners. All of us have the capacity to shed light on what another person hears. But it is still, it's changing, but I think it remains still a bit too top down for my comfort. And synagogues and temples are having to, right now, we're really, I mentioned before about how rabbis are shifting, but communities, synagogues, temples are right now really trying to figure out who they're supposed to be. As more and more people want to take control back, want to take their autonomy back.
maybe in your new branch or movement, you might adopt something that the Quakers sometimes use called a clearness committee. It's exactly what you were talking about. Someone comes with a problem or a leading or a concern or whatever, and a group of people in the community get together with them, listen to them, ask them questions, and help them get clear on what it is that they think they should be doing or what they think God is leading them to do. And having that group, and it might be, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, depends, just working together with you and not owning an opinion, but giving their interpretation of what they think God wants this person to do. And it's a very powerful thing. And we do it all the time for marriages. There's always a clearness committee for marriage. But we also do it for lots of other things. Everything from, I'm thinking about this new job, maybe I should retire. I'm led to go and travel to Moscow in the middle of the USSR and try and promote Quakerism. I mean, it's like anything, big or little. And it's very useful. Of course, we don't have rabbis. We rotate who's going to be clerk for the year. So it's a little bit different. But I freely give you clearness committee inspiration.
Thank you. I'm not a big fan of committees. I'm much more a fan of teams. But but the idea is the same.
It's just an old term versus a modern term. You know.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Anything that you would like my listeners to hear about terms to define or how to speak about people? In other words, do I say Jewish people? Do I say Jews? What is the term that is preferred?
I'm not sure if there's a...
For you.
You call me David.
I call you David, yes. But when I talk about you as a religious person...
Yeah.
I say I'm a Quaker. What do you say?
Right. I'm a Jew.
Okay.
Or I'm Jewish.
Jewish. Okay.
Yeah. One of the two. One of the two. Yeah. Jewish people, Jews, Jewish, any of those really works.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's so hard these days to know whether the words that I learned 50 years ago are still accepted, appropriate.
Politically correct. Of course. Yeah.
And not, you know, going to insult anyone. Okay, so we've got the people, we've got the leaders, we've got the name of the congregation building, all that other stuff. Do Jewish people move from one place to another place? I mean, obviously, if you change jobs and you move from location, you have to. But do they tend to stay in one style of church? I know you haven't, but is that you're not typical, are you?
probably not. I'm probably not all that typical. I think for the most part, Jews don't affiliate with a particular synagogue or community because of the movement that it's a part of,
okay,
or because of the prayer book that it uses. I think they affiliate maybe because their friends are there, or because they like the rabbi, or it's a nice building. You know, for all the same reasons. Yeah, all the same reasons that we would choose one gym over another gym, or going to that Starbucks over that Starbucks, you know, because we know someone there, or that's where it's closer to home. So I think there are a lot of different factors. But yeah, people can move around wherever they want. And we saw a lot of that during the pandemic, you know, when synagogues had to close their doors. And all of a sudden, we learned, oh my goodness, I can pray in New York. And then 3 hours later, I can pray in California. And then 3 hours, you know, or 3 hours before New York, I could pray in London. And I'm doing the same service in all three places. That's pretty cool. And so I think a number of people, not the majority by any stretch, but a number of people did sort of explore different Jewish experiences. And that's fantastic. That's just fantastic.
Do you have to be Jewish to be part of a synagogue?
Well, it depends on what you mean be a part of. So look, if you were to walk into our synagogue here, mm-hmm, no one's going to ask you if you're a Jew. You're here. You're part of the family. Welcome. Good to have you here. Right. Do you want to join and officially be a member? That's a little different. For that, generally, you do have to be Jewish.
But if I was to join, wouldn't I then become Jewish?
No.
Is Jewish not a membership thing? It's a birth thing?
No. So there are two ways to become Jewish. You are either born Jewish, meaning your mother is Jewish, and in some parts of the Jewish world, your father is Jewish, or you convert. And conversion is a process of you go through some study, you go to a ritual bath. If you're male, you have either a circumcision or a little sort of a ritual circumcision, not the real thing. And then you're welcomed into the Jewish people. Joining the synagogue is much more like joining a gym. You're paying dues for the upkeep of the air conditioning unit and to pay the rabbi's salary and to have, tuna fish and egg salad after services, after worship. So just because you join a synagogue does not mean you're a Jew. It means you've essentially joined a club. And there are lots of different clubs and they all have different fees. And so, but when it comes to who can join, again, and we are very much in process around this whole question of what does membership mean? What does community mean? What does join mean in the 21st century? I think we need to radically redefine these words, or they are, I should say, they're being redefined, and it's up to us to become a part of that redefining. That, anybody can walk into a synagogue and they will be welcomed. Period. Full stop. Everyone should be and will be welcomed. If you want to become a member of the synagogue, generally you have to be Jewish. If you're married to someone who's Jewish, then usually, depending on the community, you can become a member. And if you want certain honors during worship, you need to be Jewish. In the same way that I would feel, I imagine that a priest would feel uncomfortable inviting me as a Jew to, hand out the wafers during the sacrament, because it's not appropriate. It doesn't, there's a mismatch. The same is true in the Jewish world, that, if we're doing something that is a uniquely Jewish expression of a uniquely Jewish idea, then we generally reserve that for people who are either born into Judaism or who have chosen to become a part of the Jewish people.
And I think you might be surprised if you came to a Catholic church here in town, and I introduced you to the priest or whatever they're calling these people today. You might be surprised, because it is that religion is not a people. I mean, it's not a genealogical history. My parents, grandparents came from Germany, came from England, came from France. It doesn't matter as far as most of the Protestant religions, Catholic religion. So I think that's a big difference in this. So
Fair enough.
I'll keep that one in mind then. All right, let's move on. So we've done this, we've done this. You told us a little bit how you got here. We're not going to have time to do everything today. So I want to know about David. I want to know about what you're doing these days. Now, you told us about being a teacher, but you're also doing all this tech stuff. So what all projects are you working on simultaneously this year?
If it's okay with you, I'd actually want to start by just redefine how I redefine tech. A lot of synagogues at the beginning of this were really, and continue to be, I think, worried about having too much technology in the sanctuaries, in their sacred spaces. They don't want to have screens up or cameras or things like that. And I've had to remind folks that chairs are technology, books are technology. That these things that allow us to move forward and engage and teach and communicate with people in new ways, these are all technologies. Now, these happen to be digital technologies, but they're no different than any of the changes that we've gone through before. And so what I've really been trying to do is help synagogues become Jewish futurists. and try and not play catch up with everyone else, but decide what they want their future to be. What is their Jewish community going to look like in the 21st century and beyond? There was a question that someone posted on Facebook in one of the groups that I'm in the other day, asking people about their bulletins. You know, how many times do you send out an email bulletin? Do you send it out once a month? Do you send it out twice a month? Do you send a hard copy? And I put in the comments, I said, how about a blog where people can comment on what you write? And you can really engage with people in conversation. Or how about a podcast? Or how about this? We are very much stuck in 1980s, 1990s thinking when it comes to communication and using technology in Jewish spaces. And so I'm spending a lot of time trying to help folks not think outside the box, but buy a new box or anything, because if we keep doing what we've been doing and throw up a camera or put it on the internet, then we should just close now. Mm-hmm. We're done. If we cannot innovate, if we cannot discover the technologies that will allow us to inspire the next generation and reach the next generation, then we're really missing the mark. So that's really where my heart is. All the toys that I get to play with along the way, they're toys and they're tools, and I love them. And I've spent quite a bit of time setting myself up in such a way that I can do my best teaching, my best work. Mm-hmm. But none of this is nearly as important as the visioning.
It sounds as though the people that you are talking with, who are perhaps in some ways going, you know, how often do I send out an email announcement? Well, that would be once a week. That's when I send out my paper one. But what I hear you're suggesting is much less of the synagogue is telling the people what's going to happen, and much more of a, let's talk about this in community. And that sounds like what you were describing as old style and new style of the synagogue.
Right. It's product. It's becoming a platform rather than a product. Mm-hmm. Synagogues have been selling themselves and products. We've been selling religious school. We've been selling membership. We've been selling access to the rabbi. We've been selling worship and celebrations. And what we need to do is transition to become a platform that empowers people to create those experiences themselves, create those products, if you will, themselves.
Maybe it could go further than that and become a community rather than being a distribution point.
Absolutely. Well, a platform, I mean, the whole idea for me, at least, behind a platform is that it is a space in which community can be built. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't even want to create the community. I want to create the space in which the community can be created by those people who want to create it. And I think that one of the traps that we fall into is we create a program or we create a subgroup and then we invite everyone to it instead of allowing those to more organically evolve and become.
And that may work for you since you have a captive audience. I mean, if you're Jewish, that's you're Jewish. Whereas if you make a platform, maybe nobody will come.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I've been a little frustrated doing the Birding with Lois thing, and I'm trying really hard to make it a great place to be, but I haven't been able to reach the people who I think would enjoy being there and get them to come. And you've got a captive audience.
Well, yes and no. Yes and no. I think that I think two things. I think, first of all, one of the greatest gifts that I get is when someone I've never heard of reaches out to me or posts something on Facebook and says, I love your song, right? I've been singing this. We've been singing this song in my community, and I've never heard of this person. I have never heard of the community. So number one, we don't know the impact of our reach. That's number one. And number two, and this has happened to me a bunch of times, sometimes the spaghetti that you throw at the wall doesn't stick, and that's okay. Right? And true technologists, the big technology companies, when they're at their best, they fail fast. And so I always want to be a fail fast kind of guy. Sometimes I fail too fast. That is to say, it's not going the direction I want. And so I stop it and I try something new. Sometimes I need to be more patient with myself and with whatever I'm working on. But I think it's okay for us to say, I'm going to try this. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Then I'll try something else.
Yeah.
And don't ever imagine that even the littlest thing that you do can't have a meaningful impact somewhere. You may never hear about it, but it can have an impact.
Oh, I believe that. I know that. When I was in college and started Davis Women's Books, which is a little radical bookstore in town, and we ran it as students volunteer, nobody got paid, but it paid the rent and it bought the books and it did that stuff. And it was years later that I had someone get back to me and say, your presence and your creation of that bookstore made my life so different and was so inspiring. And it was like, oh, okay, well, I was just frustrated because we couldn't find these books in town, so I made a place to do it. I mean, it's like, but you're right. You never know what effect you will have on people. And so do your best.
That's right.
That's all you can do is do your best.
Absolutely. I was someone, a former student of mine, who I haven't had any contact with for 7, 8, 9 years. Mm-hmm. I did his bar mitzvah, reached out to me 2 weeks ago and said, hey, been thinking about Judaism lately and I wanted to reach out to you. Like, what a gift, yeah. What a blessing that is. Yeah. I had no idea that I had any impact on him whatsoever. He was a pain in the butt 13-year-old kid who didn't want to have his bar mitzvah. And I was forcing him. You have to study, you have to study. But look at that. You know, look at that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to take a minute to ask you about Revelation. Because I heard you say, all the people gathered here on this mountain, all the people in our past, and all the people to come, the revelation has happened for all of them right then. And so doesn't that mean that... Or does that mean that when someone is born, they already have had a revelation before their birth? Or does it mean that it's going to happen to them? You know it's going to happen to them because of who they are. How does that work?
So I want to ask all of your listeners to take their pointy finger and put it right underneath their nose into that little groove. Right there.
Oh, on your lip.
On top of your lip, under your nose, that little groove. So there's a Jewish tradition that says that is there because just before you're born, an angel comes along and pops you right there on the mouth. And that's because before you're born, you know the entire Torah. You have everything is revealed to you. And right before you're born, an angel comes along and puts that there and erases your entire memory.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because the point of life is to learn.
All right.
The point of life is to receive revelation. If you already have it all, then what's the point? Right? So there's this tradition is that we do have it all. Our souls, as it were at Mount Sinai, and then we forget it right before we're born. I think of it a little differently, and that is that many years ago, we were going through a difficult financial time in my family, and knowing that I'm a techie, my wife and my daughters bought me an iPad and they gave it to me and I got really upset because I didn't feel like we could afford it and I returned it. That's a really good example of there's a difference between someone giving you a gift and you receiving the gift. They gave it to me, but I did not receive it. And so there can be a great distance between the giving of a gift and the receiving of a gift. So my personal theology is that God may have given the gift of revelation at Mount Sinai some, 3,000 whatever years ago. But receiving that gift is something that happens every moment of every day for each of us. And it goes back to what you were saying earlier about, shut up and listen, right? how much of that revelation we actually are able to appreciate is really up to us. It's there. It's screaming from the mountaintops, as it were. And we just have to quiet the world around us enough so that we can hear a little bit of that and allow ourselves to be in that space.
I would like to share an image of God that moved me many, many years ago. We had, now Quakers have silent worship, so we don't really talk about stuff like that, right? But we have second hours where we can do things. And in one of them, we had a question posed, how do you envision God if you do? And so everybody went around the room, and there was, like, you know, the big man in the sky, and there was an ocean of love that is swirling around us and swoops down and goes through our lives, you know, all these different images. And the one that I liked the best was, God's the ocean, and each of us is a tide pool. We're temporarily separated from God, but we're made up of the things of God. And so
that's beautiful.
Whatever I have, and you know, maybe I've got two starfish and a sea anemone. Well, I got one of those starfish from my mom. She had a starfish too. And so the ocean comes in and goes out, and it, things may change from me to in generation, but that thought that whatever I learn or accumulate or do in this life, when I'm done, I'm just going to be, all of it's going to be back in the ocean of God.
Right.
And so it was a very powerful image, and I've enjoyed that.
That's beautiful. I'll tell you mine. So 20 years ago, in March of 2002, actually February, March of 2002, my second daughter was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Mm-hmm. And she had surgery. The surgery was successful, but then what they thought was a benign brain tumor turned out to be a very, very aggressive malignant tumor, and she died 3 weeks later. Mm-hmm. We spent those 3 weeks at Children's Hospital, and we were in what's called the comfort corner, which was a special room that, you know, they put all of the medical stuff behind wooden cabinetry to make it look a little more comfortable for us. And you have a dedicated nurse the entire time. And one of our nurses who was with us the majority of the time, her name was Cece. Cece had this amazing ability to be entirely and fully present and yet completely invisible. When we needed her, she was there before we even asked. And when we didn't need her, it's like she wasn't even in the room. And I was ordained as a rabbi, excuse me, 1 month after she passed away, my daughter passed away. And in my talk, because we all get to give a little teaching, I said, the next time someone asks me, where's God? I'm going to tell them to go to the 9th floor of Children's Hospital and ask for a nurse named Cece. Because if there was ever an experience that I had where God was embodied in the actions of another, it was through Cece and the love and compassion and professionalism and every grace that she shared with us. So I'm all about the imagery of we are each a part of God. Mm-hmm. And God is in each of us. Mm-hmm. And again, just like, you know, shut up and listen, it's up to us whether or not we want to let God express God's self in the world. Mm-hmm. It's entirely up to us.
Okay, so one last thing about, I don't know, what's our last thing? David, we've only got a couple minutes.
Our last thing. I have a question for you. Where does your love for birding come from?
Oh, that's just one of many things that I like to do. Mostly I'm an artist. I used to have my own business called The Organizer, so I was in business for a long time.
What was that? What kind of work was that?
Oh, helping people keep the papers from taking over their lives, or teaching how to use computers, or setting up, you know, retrieval systems for their filing papers, or helping them start a new business. Whatever people needed, it was wonderful. But the birding thing is because I was a docent at the Arboretum for many, many years. And at one point, I went into the office and I said, you know, you've got spring programs, docent led, and you've got fall programs, docent led. And of course, kids are gone in the summer, but you don't have anything in the winter. And they said, well, it's cold and wet and raining. Who wants to go outside in the winter? And I said, but you have things like that lady who comes in and teaches how to do botanical drawing. You don't have to be outside for that. You're inside in the library. So you could do stuff in the winter. And they said to me, okay, Lois, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I guess I'll give a beginning birding slideshow, because there are birds that are here in the winter that aren't in the summer. So I'll do a little slideshow, and that's what I'll do. That's how it started. And it wasn't that I am definitely not a bird expert. I am definitely not a birding enthusiast in trying to get a life list that has every bird in the world or something like that. No, I just enjoy stuff and I like teaching. So I did that slideshow about 12 years ago. I got some of the photographers on Flickr. I wrote to them and said, I love your bird picture. Can I use it in my slideshow? It won't be recorded or published. It'll just be shown, an educational thing. They all said yes. And that's how it started. In December, I went on After Hours and I said, well, so this is what I've been doing. And I'm thinking, maybe I can up it a little bit. And I was thinking they were going to do things like, well, on your slideshow, you could do this or that or that, or yeah, you could do it on Zoom and, you know, do the, well, 25 people jumped on the bandwagon and said, oh, we're going to do a birding project. It'll be like office hours, but for birds. And we'll have, you know, live Q&A with a bunch of panelists and all this stuff. And it was like, oh, okay. And we'll do it weekly. And Lois will be the host. And it's like, okay, I can do this. But it was not because birding was my passion, though don't tell anybody on After Hours that it's not my passion, because there are so many of them who have started seeing birds where they hadn't used to see birds, and they always come back to me and go, oh, Lois, look what I saw, or what's this? So
that's great.
And we didn't even get to rock and roll. We got to do this again, David.
We'll do rock and roll another time.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us. You have been listening to KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California. My name is Lois Richter. The program is That's Life. And today, David, my guest is David Paskin. Thank you for being on the show, David.
Real honor to be with you, Lois.
Bye-bye, everybody. I'll see you next week.